The phoenix and the dragon in traditional Japanese tattoos symbolize harmony and power. That there is no inner strength without harmony. Brought to you by your two co-hosts, Brian Comstock, an e-commerce brand builder in the field of ergonomics with GetNeely.com. He's experimented with every form of scientifically validated human advancement, ranging from MDMA-assisted therapy, ayahuasca retreats, to peptides and stem cells. Scott Conway is a lead generation and sales expert who has a Hyros.com certified lead generation agency, LGG Media. He is a dragon.
Episode 10, The Phoenix and the Dragon. We have a very special guest that I'm excited to introduce and bring on. He's probably the most interesting person in the world, and will live up to that title with his story. But before we dive in, Brian Comstock, how you doing?
Doing very well. That's what we said about the last guy, but honestly, we just get really interesting people. Like, we genuinely get very interesting people, which is what makes it so fun.
How are you doing, sir?
Not too bad, Scott. It's nice to connect again. Hello, Brian.
How are you?
Not too bad, man. Not too bad. So, I'm doing all right.
Before we give you like the intro of the real life Nigerian prince, a mutual friend of ours is saying that the first time that I met Judeofor was at an event. It was like a mastermind networking kind of thing, and he said that your dad was a king in your tribe back in Nigeria. Walk us through that. Is that true? What's the story there?
Unfortunately, he never replied to my emails. You missed the $1 million I was going to try to get out of the country when my dad died. So that's on you. So, if you know the popular story that goes about the Nigerian prince who's sending emails around saying he has $1 million under the bed or something happened, he's been bereaved, and he reaches out to different people online and asks them to help him keep the money safe. And then the people who reply get taken down a well-planned script and are siphoned or defrauded of their personal wealth. So that's a very popular Nigerian prince story. So that's what I just gave you there. But anyway, walking you through the real life Nigerian prince story. Yes, it's true. My dad is a king. He's late. He passed away last year. And yeah, that's what it is.
So we know what it's not, but what is it?
Yeah, that was so much more effortless Nigerian prince story versus like the actual Nigerian prince. So now that we're interesting, was just like an undernote.
So now that we just explained half my spam messages, let's get into what a real Nigerian.
Honestly, it's I really don't know. I've never lived my life thinking that there's much to it, but in the sense of what comes with that. So I come from a community. This community is, let's say, maybe there's about 10 to 15,000 people kind of thing. And it's community that's under a bigger framework, which is called a local government. And the local government is under a state. So the king of the community is the first direct line to the people, to the grassroots. So we have a couple of kings, and in the case of my family, it's passed from generation, from my grandfather to my father. And on my mother's side as well, it's the same thing. It's passed from her great grandfather to her father. And so that's what it is. But a lot of people make a big deal out of being a king or a prince. But in my own situation, I never really grew up feeling like a prince or the son of a king. So I can't really tell you any other thing or whatever pecs it comes with. But of course, when I go back home, people are happy to have me. There's the traditional entitlements that come with it. And yeah.
Sounds like being that got to your head a lot less than it would get to my head. So it sounds like you have a pretty grounded feel with it, and it doesn't sound like it's the end all be all of how you look through the world. So that's really interesting. Yeah.
What do you attribute that to?
A couple of things, but so I didn't grow up with my father from the beginning. That's one. And by the time that we met, I had formed certain opinions about different things. And I had, I guess my mom had drummed it into my head that, listen, just go out like a normal person and don't go trying to be something. And so it never was a thing for me. Maybe it's all the things, all the words from my mom saying, hey, dude, listen, focus. Don't even think about that. So I guess that's where it came from. And it's been a blessing.
Interesting. And so walk us through, like, how did you first, how old were you when you first moved to China? And then why did you choose China of all places to get an MBA?
I moved to China at the age of 28. This was way down my life in terms of my career life. I'd been working already for 10 years. And moving to China was not something I saw happening. The same way, funny enough, moving to Canada was not something I saw happening. So I had been working living in Abuja, which is the capital city of Nigeria. And I'm a hustler right from when I was young. I've always been doing little things, selling this, flipping that, setting up this small business. So the point is, at that time, Alibaba was like the time Alibaba was just like doing all the import export, and you could all of a sudden just go to this website and find a whole lot of products. So I got excited and I go on Alibaba, I go buy suits, and I keep flipping these suits while I work in the city and everything. So after some time of working, after 10 years, and after from 2008 to 2014, so after 6 years of working, I got bored and I'm like, so what to do? I'm like, okay, so I would like to go study, pursue this passion of actually seeing the world. And my first choice was to go to the UK. However, I just felt, you know what, when I go to the UK, it's going to be the same experience of, there's a lot of Nigerians in the UK, so I felt like I wouldn't have an original experience. So in 2013, I said, okay, let me try to go to the UK and see how I feel about it. And when I went, I had a good time, but I'm like, it's still not the place I want to be. I'm just going to be with the same old. And then, because I had no other choice anyway, and I really wanted to leave and do something new, go on an adventure, I decided to apply to schools in the UK. So I had a close friend who was studying at Brunel University, and I reached out to her to ask her, hey, how's Brunel? And while we're talking, I all of a sudden remember that I saw a picture of her on the Great Wall of China. And I'm like, hey, by the way, did you just go to study in China for some time? And she said, yeah, I did. And I'm like, oh, wow, how was that? And she's, I really don't know what to say. You just have to see it by yourself. And that's stuck in my head. I'm like, oh, I said, okay, fine. Send me the information of how to study in Brunel and all that. But I had lost interest in that. I was now online researching China. And going online to research China, MBA in China, everything is half the price. So when you're seeing like MBAs in the US for like 100K, 80K, 200K, you're seeing China at 30. I'm like, wow, this is interesting. And when you read about China, there's so much, 5,000 years of history. I just got really tuned into this and I got excited. It was different from trying to go to the UK. So I'm like, you know what? I think this is going to be it. And I just applied to, this was like in June, and the session was going to start in September. So I just Googled schools in China and I applied to the first five schools that popped up on the list. And three schools replied and said, you know what, we're sorry, we can't take you. It's already too late. And one school replied and said, you're right on time. We have our first ever English MBA class starting this fall. And if you want to join us for that, we'll be happy to have you. And even to add to that, I eventually found a scholarship, which helped me fund half of my tuition. So that's it. Like, you know, July, August, September, in 3 months, everything happened so quickly. And in 3 months, my bags were packed up and I was going to China. And the funny thing is, everybody was just like, oh, yes, that's so typical of you. what, where else would you go but somewhere really far away where nobody can reach you and everything. So I was really happy about China. That's how that happened. And there I was in September, off to China, knew nobody, couldn't speak the language. They didn't know what to expect, but I was just very happy that I was just disappearing.
That's amazing. I have a very like watered down version of that just to try to relate. As I was planning a trip with two of my closest friends and cousins, and a similar thing. It's like, okay, this is a once in a lifetime opportunity. For you, it's MBA school. For me, it was this 10-day trip with two of my closest family members. And it's like trying to decide and say, yeah, we go to Europe, we go to the UK, but just kind of like you said, there's nothing wrong with all of that. It's not, we've done it before. It's not that unique. And so my cousin was like, why not just make a right turn and go to Japan? And that was by far and away the most unique, my favorite vacation ever, my favorite experience, like overall for a 10-day period. But it's the same concept of like, sometimes when you venture into what's going to create the most like new experience for you, and that there's something really enriching about that. And so I can relate to that kind of logic of what's going to be new and exciting versus,
yeah,
it's okay, but it's there's so much of the world to really experience, so many different cultures and everything. So if you're already used to Western culture, then
yeah,
you're already used to it. So why not try something else?
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought as well. And I've been better off for it. I've been living that experience up until this day. And just like you mentioned in Japan as well, I actually have a similar story, which was the last trip I made in Asia before leaving was going to Japan. And just before we went to Japan, myself and my partner were also like, we don't know what to expect. And then up to date, Tokyo has been the best, like Japan has been the best trip of my life.
It's the best trip. It's the best. I did Tokyo. Kyoto was my favorite. Tokyo was wonderful. And Hakone, but the whole experience was like insane. It's actually, yeah, Japan's a whole other rabbit hole. But it's just mind blowing how stuff works. Like I've been to New York. You just assume if there's a city, there's going to be trash, there's going to be noise, there's going to be clutter, there's going to be homeless people, there's going to be all this crap in your way. You go to Tokyo, it's like freaking, I don't know, first or second, I don't know, literally, but it's like in my world, it's the biggest city in the universe. You can't see the end of it, no matter where you are.
No matter where.
And it's quiet, clean, no gum, no litter. It's just so eye-opening that these things we take for granted of actually, it's not necessarily the case that there's shit all over the street, literal or metaphorical. It's actually like there's other ways of doing things. And that's what Japan, that's like my cliff notes of Japan, is just a really good eye opener of what you take as a given and as a default is not necessarily the case, because they're doing things very differently. So it's just a beautiful experience.
Example of peak operational efficiency.
It is.
I've never been, but always wanted to go.
We'll get out there.
Yeah. So it's interesting mentioning doing things differently. That's what I've held since I went to live in Asia. Growing up in Nigeria, Nigeria is one of the, it's in the Commonwealth. A lot of people, like my mom's, as far back as my mother's generation, they all went on scholarships to the US and studied in Penn State and came back to Nigeria after living in the US for maybe 15 years or something like that. So they are all pretty westernized. And growing up as a kid, we come from a big family. So half of the family is in the US and half is in Nigeria. So we always had cousins who come for Christmas or for Easter. That's like a family tradition we try to do. Our cousins come back, we all hang out, we get to know each other. So the point is, we've all gotten some exposure to the West, you know, and how things work. And that shapes you and shapes what you know. But now with the rise of China, it's now creating something to compare stuff to. And listening to you talk about how Japan, see how they do things differently. So that's what I gained from going to China, in the sense that I could also see people still pursuing the same. Is it excellence? Is it their culture? Is it innovation? People still doing the same things wanting to be happy and fulfilled and all that, but in a different culture, in a different language. They don't speak English, but you know what? They're still doing very well. So that has actually continued to shape my mindset and my outlook to life, because you get to understand that you don't have to, like, just using typical things, let's say being rich or being a billionaire, which is what everybody wants to do. You don't have to speak English to be a billionaire, but of course it sure helps. So there's a lot to dissect in that space of doing things differently. But yeah, just
in perspective of what you don't necessarily need to be a billionaire.
Yeah.
And so after, so you, cause you've done a lot of interesting businesses as well, that you do for where after your MBA, after you graduated your MBA in China, first off, where was it exactly in China? What was the city and which part of, is it was like east, west, north, like in the Gobi Desert, where exactly was it? And then after your MBA, what did you do, like entrepreneur-wise?
I lived in Tianjin, China, which is in the north of China. It's only 27 minutes by the speed train. I can remember exactly 27 minutes by the speed train from Beijing. So Tianjin is known as the backdrop of Beijing, basically. So Beijing is hustle, bustle, busy, fast. And then you go to Tianjin and it seems like time slows down. So I lived in Tianjin. My school was Nankai University in Tianjin. So life in Tianjin, basically, like I say, it's a bit slower. The people, believe it or not, have not really seen as many foreigners as you would expect. So that's the thing about China. So there's a joke we have, all we China alumni, we're like, you know what, if you ever get to a point in your life that you feel like dejected and that you have nothing else to go to China and you get renewed, because whether you are white, blue, black or green, in China, they've not seen too many other people who don't look like them. There's 1. Something billion people. So even if there's a million of you foreigners, you're still like a drop in the Chinese ocean. So the point is, living in Tianjin was very interesting in the sense that people just always stare at you. It also began to, at some point, you could take it the wrong way, because people, you could just be standing in the metro and somebody walks next to you and just stands like this. And while you're trying to figure out what's happening, pictures are being taken of you. And you've just made that person's day. Because what? He or she has gotten a picture with a foreigner. That's it. You're standing in the metro and you're in a restaurant. Somebody comes and throws their baby into your arms and goes back and takes a photo. So there's all those kind of crazy experiences in China.
That's how I was hoping it would be when I came to Medellin, and it wasn't quite the case.
Oh my goodness. So that was something. So you can imagine me at I was just living in Nigeria, hustler, everything, 28 years old, arrived in China, and somebody looks at me and he's like, hey, we're trying to start a band and we want to sing some songs by Beyonce. And we think you could really act like Jay-Z. Can you do it? I'm like, sure. And then I had a band in China. So I had like a little band, myself and three Chinese girls, my classmates. We began to sing, like our theme song was Crazy in Love. And just like that, we're going from school to school to different locations and performing Crazy in Love and different Jay-Z songs on stage. So that was China. So it was like something very different. And the truth is, I've never been a rapper in my life. And this is me on stage and I'm just performing away. And it's, I'm like, what's going on? But everybody loves it. They think, oh my God, because you're African, definitely. You're a good singer, or you're a good dancer, or you're a good rapper. Stuff. So that side, the fun side of living in China and all those other things. But in terms of other things like culture and food, most especially, it was just like, when you go, I think you get knocked out. There's just all sorts of, everything in China means something. Everyone has an idiom. Everybody has a proverb for something. So it's just interesting. It makes your mind think a lot. And then how I went into entrepreneurship, of course, coming from Nigeria, I don't know how much already about Nigeria, but we have a big entrepreneurship culture. basically everybody is trying to hustle because in places like
Igbos, especially.
Yeah, Igbos especially. Yeah. So everybody is trying to hustle. And if you don't hustle, then I'm sorry. It, like, nothing is coming your way. So that's just to put that out there. So going to China, I already became like a focal point for people who needed to connect to Chinese manufacturing. Of course, everything is now made in China, most especially in Africa, in Nigeria, where we have like little or no production being done, enough for the population. We have about 200 million people at least, and we don't have the production that we need to have all the things for these people. Everybody's importing from China, basically. So once I got there, I became my network that I already had now became like my client base. People are reaching out to you. I want this, I want that. And there's been really very interesting things that have happened in that space. But anyway, that's how I went into entrepreneurship. It just happened with, yo, Jidofa posted a picture on Facebook. Oh, he's in China. Somebody calls you up and he's like, hey, Jide, I'm trying to buy XYZ. And that's it. Being a hustler is like, you want to buy XYZ? Oh, of course, I have somebody who can provide that for you. And it just took a few more tries and I kept going with the flow until I found my foot.
What did you finding your foot mean or look like?
I think my first purchase order came. See, okay, the interesting thing is in Nigeria, a lot of people just assume that because you're in China, that means you live opposite from a factory because we have no idea how these things work. So when you say, I live in China, everybody just automatically, okay, if you want to buy XYZ, just call Jidofa, he'll go to the market and pick it up for you and bring you that kind of thing. But no, it's not like that. I live in Tianjin, right? It's just one part of China. China is humongous. And the way the factories are located in China, they have different economic zones and whatever, whatnot. But okay, like for example, Tianjin is where they do a lot of steel manufacturing. In the south is where they do a lot of light manufacturing. Anyway, long story short, it's not as easy as me just waking up tomorrow morning and walking across the street and buying that thing for you. So that's the first misconception, that you can access factories very easily. Second misconception is everybody thinks that every Chinese person is a business person. So they just feel, because in Nigeria, business is done really informally. So everybody, it's so often that we are all generalists. We are doing everything. But in China, it's different. So you'll be shocked. Like 99% of my classmates never even knew about this product I was looking for. I was even the person who was now telling them about these business opportunities. So these were the misconceptions that were in front of me, which people did not understand. And that's now what made me also find the opportunity to develop something, because I figured, I realized that, you know what, it's not really as easy as people think, that everybody here is doing business or that there's factories everywhere just waiting to attend to your orders. Or even more still, that when you have an order, you just go in and say, you know what, I want to make a Neely pad. And oh yeah, we have one on the shelf, and they give it. No, there's many different. I didn't find my food very easily. That's the point. But I had to just keep going through different motions. However, the baseline I used was I threw myself into it all. And I just, whatever you asked me for, I would.
Did you become pretty fluent in the language?
So that's the start. And that's how I also learned language. So two ways was, first, I made a lot of friends and I just mixed with as many Chinese people as possible. So that way I was able to begin to immerse. Second thing is all these little tasks that people wanted, whether I could see where the money was coming from or not, I used as an opportunity to connect. So that's, yeah, I learned the language. I learned the language on the street, actually. I'm very, when it comes to studying in school, like in class,
sorry,
you lose me. Yeah.
You prefer informal. It's a very difficult language across the board, particularly for English speakers, but that's impressive that you're able to do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
How did you, so when you were marketing, being this broker between Nigeria and then Chinese manufacturing, like how did you actually market that? And what exactly were you selling?
So that's the thing. I didn't really have a specific product for a long time. There's another story to how that affected me in the long run. But how did I market this product to the Chinese factories? The good thing about China is, you know, as much as I've said, not everybody is a business person in China, but there's still an overall framework of business and getting things done. So that means that Chinese people are very open to business. So marketing to the Chinese factory side was not always very difficult because they're very receptive for business. They want to learn. That's one thing I found in China. They are so open to learning new information. So how did I find some of these people? First, I began from friends, asking friends. And although 9 out of 10 of the friends whom I had in school did not know how I could find factories that had XYZ, the ones who gave me some recommendations were the start to how I began to find these factories. And it just took on a life of its own. And there was also going on the same websites like Alibaba, but there's Chinese versions of Alibaba that are meant for the local markets. So that was also another place where I went to find factories to market to them. And for the Nigerian people, the easiest way I could reach my contacts was, of course, aside of the familiar contacts whom you make through word of mouth, your family, your friends and everything, then social media became the point connect.
Did they not have access or familiarity with Alibaba, or do you see yourself as like the middle layer between it, or how do you like, or maybe Alibaba wasn't at a level that was common ground for a lot of people, or how did that all come into play? Because I'm trying to understand. Yeah.
So it's interesting. Yeah, that's a very good question. So there's Alibaba, but Alibaba has its problems. One was there's lots of scams on Alibaba, but that's not even the that's not what I realized at the end of the day. What I realized at the end of the day was that there were certain categories of people, but a lot, for the most part, they just needed a personal reference. So they knew Alibaba, they could go on Alibaba, they could talk to the suppliers, but for the most part, they just needed to talk to somebody who understood them and who could give them a nudge and say, go with this guy. So that became niche, I realized.
They call that boots on the ground in the e-commerce space. You were, if I'm buying from Chinese manufacturers, you're my boots on the ground to inspect quality assurance, or just like you say, general nudge that these suppliers are legitimate XYZ.
Yeah. And especially with the newer entrepreneur, I don't know your experience making Nili Pad, but when you're new, you probably need some more information about how things are done. A lot of people just, you know, read about this thing and they're like, okay, I want to start this business, but they don't know where to start from. So people like us who are over there were very easy targets for them to get the information that they needed.
Yeah, that's a whole other thing. And that's why I always get excited when I see different forms of entrepreneurial teachings, because they don't teach maybe an MBA, but I've even heard that's even debatable from what I've heard, but a lot of this stuff, they don't teach you. Like I didn't learn about Alibaba. I learned times tables and trigonometry that I would never use in my life. But so a lot of these things you are not taught formally, as you touched on. And so I get excited. It's one of my many passions, but I get excited about different ways different people are approaching like solving that problem. And so whether it's there's a million people doing it, but it's just amazing. Cause like you said, like you probably didn't know how to use Alibaba, but like you only need a little bit of like understanding, and then you open up a lot of doors. And there's a whole thing of just birthing, like finding ways to birth the entrepreneurial spirit and creativity versus the structure and rigidity of like formal education is, and it's like there's a whole other thing of like, how can we get more people? Yeah, because I've had people who are making so much money in a corporate job, and they're like, oh, I'm so curious, how did you do Nili Pad? What was the R&D like? What was the manufacturer? And when I hear like R&D, I just laugh. I'm like, it's just a whole misunderstand. Anyway, so that's a whole other rabbit hole. But for you, people like you, on a one-to-one level or on a bigger scale, helping people access these entrepreneurial sticking points, I think is beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah. I really wish somebody taught me how to use a sauna in my high school tech class.
It's not going to happen. I tell you, most of the businesses I've done, when I started, many came from just relationships. Mm-hmm. And that's the biggest advantage I got from living in China, because I'm a sociable person. I'm a people's person. I like to make contacts. I know how to maintain contacts. So I really went into factories and I met the bosses of factories, the owners of, and I didn't know that these were very valuable contacts as at the time, because like I said, that initially I was just connecting to people, and then these people invite you, oh, come, let's have a drink. And when after a few years, I now landed in the market, like I was now in the market, now talking to the older Nigerian traders who had been doing their thing, it's now when I realized, oh, they were all so surprised. They're like, you know that somebody that owns a factory, what does he sell? Oh, wow. I then knew that I really had some amazing
sitting on some gold.
Yeah, yeah. Because the thing is, a lot of this, even like for yourself, maybe when you contact the guys at Alibaba, many of them are not, I doubt you get to a factory directly. Those people are all like agents like myself, or Chinese agents. And you'd be surprised at how they function. Even sometimes it's like a bigger organization and they're just like many salespeople hustling for all those tiny
bits. You'll appreciate this because you hit something specific, but I had an instance with that where, so when you say like their ages, so a lot of times they'll just come up with a name and you think, oh, and I'll address them, hi, first name and whatever. And then I had a whole thing where this guy came to me, he's like, oh, well, that's not the real owner, or the owner screwed me over. So come with me, come take your business with me, because the real owner is like, we split ways and all this stuff. And I, for a period of time, I literally didn't know which insert first name. I didn't know which, like who, I didn't know how to identify who is my actual supplier. I literally had to like gut check slash just guess ultimately who is, I have a business. I'm trying to, I've already spent thousands on inventory. I have a whole ton of, there's a lot that's gone into this and I don't know who the fuck my supplier is, because they're both telling me. And then I went back to the other guy and he says this, and he said, oh no, that's not the case. We kicked him out of the company. He's a huge risk. He's a huge issue. And the other guy's saying the opposite thing. I literally didn't know who to believe. I didn't know who my supplier was. And so what I did at a very minimum is I just stopped saying hi font. I stopped saying hi first name. I stopped, because I'm like, I feel like an idiot addressing someone by their first name when I don't know who the fuck I'm even talking to. And it's probably not their. So it's so strange. It just like hits on what you're saying of like, you really don't know.
Yeah.
What, like, yeah.
So that's the advantage that I had meeting all those guys directly. Yeah.
I didn't have that advantage.
No,
but that's why you have Fawn 1, Fawn 2.
I literally have, I have Fawn 1 on WhatsApp. Or no, excuse me. Fawn 1 on, you know what they do? WeChat. I have Fawn 1 on WeChat and Fawn 2 on Alibaba.
Yeah.
And when I'm having a bad day, I go back to Fawn 1. But normally I just talk to Fawn 2.
Well, the thing is, even
when because I know you're in this space, so I want to give you more fodder. So then, but then Fawn 1 will try to, he'll try to increase the deal. He'll be like, well, I'll tell you what, I'll do something Fawn 2 won't do. I'll do something. I will ship your inventory and you won't have to pay me until it actually arrives. I'm like, Fawn 2 doesn't offer me that. Maybe I should go back to Fawn 1. But I'm like, wait a minute. It was literally a whole thing of like me trying to figure out who the fuck I should even interface with.
Yeah. You know, that happened. But the thing is, it's really rare to be in touch with the factory boss unless you're doing really big business. And on that level, so that also became something I had to solve. And it took me a while because, like I said, I do a lot of micro businesses. So I'm helping a lot of micro entrepreneurs. And they just have the tiny funds to do, you know, what they have to do. But it's my passion to try to help those people because I know how difficult it is. But my big factory bosses don't want those deals because it's too small.
Yeah. This is super side note. I think it's called, is it Kiva? There's a website that does like micro funding for super small businesses. You give them like $100 to start like a clothing store in somewhere in Africa. Like it's, have you ever heard of that website? It's very cool. They will, you can do very small micro loans, micro funding for these businesses. And then like, there's like a 99% like return rate and you're basically changing people's lives that are,
yeah.
But imagine the hustler in Nigeria who's like, if he got $500 US and he's like, I'll pay it back in a year and you just changed my life. It's a beautiful thing. I love seeing stuff like that.
Yeah. But
what is that organization, Brian?
I need to find the name. For some reason, I want to call it like kiva.org, but that might not be the name. I'll find it. It's something. Awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. But the supply chain and logistics involved in that. It's actually quite a difficult job, but anyway, we'll get to that.
So what was, Brian, that was a great anecdote. Thank you for sharing. It's so funny.
I need to spend 10 grand on inventory. Do I rebuy with fund number one or fund number two? These are the kind of risks you take as entrepreneurs. Like you literally, yeah. I'm not going to be my own boots on the ground for China right now. So, yeah. And I wasn't sophisticated enough to have someone like you to do it for, of like, how can I double check this and have someone verify this for me? I'm just a one man band trying to figure it out. It actually was pretty scary because it's, I literally don't know who, because without my supplier, I feel like I'm back to ground zero.
Of course.
It's a whole thing. So you're it's crazy.
Okay.
It's always, yeah.
Yeah, so what I like about that, like what I take away from that, what it meant for me being an agent in China was you had fund one, you had fund two. Just know that you could have fund 10. That's it. So that's it. So that's also coming back to the part of the marketing that we talked about, like how do you meet the suppliers and everything? So it's so competitive of an industry that everybody is trying to offer you something, right? But it also has its own disadvantages of you accepting whatever you're offered, but it's at the level where, you know what, you could really play hard to get customers.
The consumer customer.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Because you have fund one, you have fund 10. It's, you know what? So we were courted. So we were seen as gateways to whatever networks we had, a gateway to Nigeria, a gateway to Canada, a gateway to the US. So that's something about the marketing there.
So where are you still involved with this? Or I would love a snapshot of where things are, how that all progressed / where you are now with on a business front with some of these different ventures, or how that all evolved for you.
Yeah. So it's matured a little bit more and I've moved out of the sourcing as a service directly, but I now have a team that does that. So what I eventually did with that is I made it into like a relief package that would help some Nigerian young entrepreneurs to make money for themselves. Because like I said, there's too much logistics involved in the sourcing, which I couldn't get bogged down with anymore. And now I've gone a little bit further into narrowing into fashion wholesale as what, you know, dealing with at the moment. But going further in there, we're still in some kind of limbo. But yeah, that's where we are now.
It sounds like you were very, like you said, there's a hustler ethos and culture in Nigeria. And it sounds like you were very much just figuring things out. Did you have any sort of mentor or guidance or other ways of garnering ideas and support as you navigated all these different waters?
I didn't have like direct mentors, okay, but we just learn from the system and you see what people are doing. Nigerians are very, very enterprising.
Industrious.
It's what it is. Look, it's either you swim or you sing. So it's, you make up your mind early enough.
Yeah, because Ty Lopez told me I can't function in society if I don't have a mentor. So I was just wondering if you had.
I mentor. You know what? It's like I choose different I don't yet have a mentor, to be honest. I just identify different people and copy different stuff from them. I don't know how that thing.
That's equally, if not more interesting to me, is just self-reliance, right? So it's obviously advantageous to have someone who's been there, done that, who can share these learnings and wisdom with you. Not everyone has that. And definitely not everyone has it all the time. And so in different phases of your life, in different phases of your entrepreneurial journey, you're lucky if you get it at any point and on any juncture. So it's just a good proof point that you're just a really inspiring story of just that spirit, and that self-reliance can take you pretty far.
That's it, man. That's it. I had to learn very early. I'm the guy who came from failing all my classes and being a bum at some point, and everybody's, you know what, it's not gonna amount to anything. So I have to rebuild myself. And even at this time, I'm sure I'm not even halfway yet, but I'm really building this job machine. That's where I am right now.
Judeofor, in reflecting on more on Nigeria, just from an outside perspective looking in, it's a market of 200 million people, that it's very dense, like population wise. And I know that you have a lot to share about the Igbo tribe as well. But looking at it, say, for example, if somebody wanted to expand into Nigeria, because we live in a global economy, like my manager of my call center team, inside sales manager, is Nigerian. He's one of the best hires that we've ever made, like one of the smartest people as well that I've ever met. So as a labor market, what can, say somebody wants to expand, what are some of the strengths of Nigeria and what can it offer international investors as well as companies?
That's a very interesting question, because where my sourcing story led me to eventually in China was becoming an investment consultant. So after I had done all the boots on ground, made all those contacts, at some point, it was just obvious that I could put all this together as a product in investment consulting. And that's what I finally worked in before I left China. So in terms of Nigeria, going to Nigeria for investment, it's a very attractive market. But there is no one specific answer I can give you to say, this is how you should go, this is what you should do. And the reason is because the market is still pretty much unregulated.
Still frontier.
Yeah, and still finding its way. But the best advice that I will give you in going to invest in Nigeria, there's a couple of them. First is, it's the market of the future because we have the population. Number two is, your partner is the most important thing that you need to find in order to go into the market, because a lot of things still have to do with local knowledge. It's very different from the market that you're used to. So the strength of your local partner will determine your success. Every other thing about if it's going to be a profitable venture, I strongly believe and can provide statistics that would support that fact. But the other thing that you need to do is you need to have staying power. And your staying power would have to involve the learning curve. You have to be ready to learn and unlearn what you know already. And then you just have to have the resilience to stick in the market.
That's one of my favorite, it's one of the quotes that I remember, is it's what you learn after you think you already know everything that matters.
Yeah. So that's what markets like Nigeria will teach you. That's what I also enjoyed in China. Not enjoyed, but that's what I learned in China as well. Just different ways of doing things, right? It takes you away from this formality of this is how things should be done, which is actually a good thing. You feel a certain level of safety probably in those formalities. But what these other markets like Asia and Africa do to you is that they teach you the importance of connecting to your market directly, being a people's person, really understanding the culture and how it works. Because in those markets, you're as good as the people whom you interact with, in the sense that they may want different. I'll give you a typical example. This happens everywhere, but I was selling pet toys at some point on Amazon and I liquidated the store. After liquidating the store.
Peptides?
Yeah, pet toys.
Pet toys.
Yeah, pet toys.
Okay.
Yeah. Pet toys.
And I sent this product to Nigeria. And you know what? Because it had some shiny little lights in it, kids decided that this was like a good fit for being a child's toy. And if you don't understand the market concept.
It works the same way for adult toys too. If you look at Instagram, just give me some fancy colors. We're all
hooked. No, anyway.
If you just get some shiny little color ridden toy or app and next thing you know, it's like a whole $1 billion thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry. Didn't mean to.
Yeah. Not to segue. Yeah. Not to segue else, but it's just that things like the product may be something else understood in a different way by the people there. And if you're fixated on the way you think the product should work, then you lose a big market. Yeah.
Interesting. It's funny. A friend of mine wanted to prioritize like expansion to somebody brought up friend and it's Nigerian. Somebody brought up to expanding into Canada. And he's like, why would we expand into Canada when we can expand into Nigeria? Nigeria has 200 million people. Canada has 40 million people.
Low barriers to entry as well. Those are very interesting things over there.
Interesting. So it was funny. I actually quick anecdote, but I was in the airport in Dubai, flying from Dubai to Turkey, one of the lounges, and I just started talking to this gentleman that was in the lounge, and he was Nigerian. He was from the north of Nigeria. I can't remember the name of the tribe, but more religious. What is it? I know it's like a two word.
Hausa.
Yes. Yeah. Hausa. He was Hausa. And he just started telling me about his carpet business. And he showed me this entire shipping container full of carpets. And it just blew my mind that it's just, yeah, it's very much like an outward facing country. It's very dynamic. It's on its way to becoming very dynamic economically. So Judeo-4.
Let me give you even more interesting stories. So there's people in Nigeria, right, who produce so much products. Like they make, they have such a thriving business, but they don't bank their cash. And it's surprising to see those kind of industries in Nigeria. And why I remember this, because you talked about the Hausa man whom you met, who was showing the carpets and everything. The essence of the story is just to let you understand how the market thrives, even though a lot of people don't understand it that way. And they just look at it and say, that's a local African market. Nothing is really happening there. So there was a time that we went to visit one factory that makes bags, the bags that are used in bagging cement. We have one of the biggest cement manufacturers, Dangote Cement, in Nigeria. And he makes a lot of his bagging. This particular factory supplies him those bags. And everybody from overseas, we all hear about Lagos State and how big Lagos State is, and Lagos is doing a lot of business. But there's a state called Kano State, and Kano State has even maybe more population than Lagos State. It's in the north.
That's in Kano, is in the north.
It's in the north. And this guy's factory is so huge. He can't even, like, for the bags that he makes for this Dangote Cement, he can't even take any orders. He can't take any other orders from anybody because he's just swamped with so much work. There's stories like that, even with my business. Just doing my sourcing business in 2020, 2021, we hit 7 figures. And why this is interesting is because.
Is that in USD or NGN?
In CAD.
Okay.
Yeah, in CAD.
That's a currency joke, Brian.
Yeah.
Of like the Nigerian is, it's like, oh, what is it, like 500,000 for. That was 5,000 for 1 USD. Sorry.
Yeah, it's so the thing is, these are crazy stories because these are not things that these are not things that would happen here in the space of time that it happens there. That's one. Another story is one that relates to Declan, who is one of our bodies in the Man and Meaning thing. So recently I went to do some clothing, wholesale clothing sales in Nigeria. And I'm just on my way to Nigeria and I hit up Declan. I'm like, oh, Dec, I have some clothes I'm going to sell off in Nigeria. And if you know anybody who is interested, just let me know. And I never put any thought into that because I was just informing him about my trip. And what happens? 3 months later, the guy who Declan referred to me closed like 100K, just like that. So these are crazy stories that you would not expect to happen in that market, in that industry, because everything is a little bit very unregulated or not documented as it is being documented in every other place. So I think those are stories to study a bit further. The bottom line is that there's a lot of business going on in Nigeria that it's not going to happen here for me and you in 3 months. You make 100K just like that. Or in 1 year, you just start this business that doesn't have any big social media presence or this big YouTube following or this big website presence, and you're making 7 figures in a year. But the point is, the market is so underserved and so needy and starving that there's tons of opportunities in this market. So all you hear really are like the stories of the scams. So how this happened? Yeah, those ones happen as well. But if you have, like I said, the good partner who is going to be able to guide you, then I think that's a start.
Yeah, that's so fascinating. You hear, there's just the first thing that I read a lot of geopolitics and I'm relatively obsessed with it and history. And a lot of the comparison, the economic comparisons of Nigeria is like India 10, 20 years ago. And it seems that there's a lot of that rapid kind of scaling happening in India, and why there's like this now super rich class in India that's almost come out of nowhere. Because and what's very similar, when we looked at call center staff in India, one of the times you were getting like PhD applicants to work, get us inside sales jobs. And Nigeria, it seems to be very similar, where that intense population density not just creates insane amounts of competition for work and opportunities, but also insane demand for, especially given the fact that it's a frontier, what it is that you're saying is that there's a lot of opportunities to service that demand.
There is a lot of opportunity to service that demand. So that actually was a bit of a roadblock for me when I initially came to Canada. Not a roadblock, but that was my reality, in the sense that I was already so chimed into that market that I could not focus on the Canadian market or start the Canadian market for a while, until somehow I got forced to now start to look at the Canadian market. But it's a very interesting market in Nigeria. It could give you tons of scenarios like the ones I've just given you already, where that's where it's actually happening. There's many of my peers, they're like, you know what, I really don't want to go anywhere else. I think that's what happens to a lot of Nigerians, right? When you see Nigerians are always very excited about Nigeria, is because of opportunities like this. There's people whom their slogan is, you know what, yeah, I can be good anywhere else in the world, but in Nigeria, where I want to be here, because I can be great, because there's still this no barriers to entering the market and making a difference, because it's a very starving market. So that's something I think is very interesting about that Nigerian market.
Brian, what do you think? Fuck this podcast. Let's go. Let's do some solar panels and DIY.
Yeah. I'm like, wow. Sounds. Yeah. It just, you're familiar with, so I have the Neely pad and so I'm always constantly learning this stuff. And it's like the same principles apply. That's, so a lot of people sell on Amazon, and then a lot of people market on Amazon through Amazon, PPC or whatever. When you do what everyone else does, it just becomes more expensive, more competitive. And so the real key is like finding these other ways of doing what your competition is not doing. like expanding to Nigeria, like finding other ways to harness and manage Amazon outside of Amazon and like all these sort of things. Yeah, it sounds like an incredible opportunity that's like, well, relatively untapped. And yeah, I think all three of us had that kind of like hustler's filter through the world of like, where's a good opportunity? I barely speak one language at this point. So it's one of those things. That's where like the internet, like expanding internationally has always been a little bit intimidating on from a cultural and language front, but not impossible as we're witnessing here.
Yeah, that's no, it's in Canada now, like following all the networks I follow, like Startup Canada and people like Invest Ottawa, there's a lot of talk about going global, businesses trying to help businesses go global. And I think that the next decade, we're going to see a whole lot more of those moves, be it from Canada to Nigeria or Nigeria to Canada. For example, there's Nigerian businesses already, African businesses who are expanding outwards, especially in the fintech. So fintech is a big scene right now in Nigeria. Fintech, blockchain, Web3, there's a lot going on in that space. And a lot of the companies are now beginning to look outwards, like where to go to. So what my experience from living in China, coming from Nigeria, living in North America has taught me is we should not take lightly cultural integration and the power of the future. There's, for example, I'll use a typical example like WeChat, okay? Brian, you use WeChat for your Chinese business. So when I first arrived in China, just looking at the WeChat app, it's just so integrated with everything. And the like for WhatsApp and WeChat, honestly, you can't put them side by side. You're going to throw WhatsApp away. So the point is cultural integration really brings different ideas to life that you would find gold mines in just this new knowledge that if you close your mind to, because it's a different culture that you don't understand, you'll be losing a lot. So I look at it in that sense, like in the future, we don't know where the Facebook is going to come from. What is it going to be? According to like the Facebook TikTok or Instagram TikTok thing now, they say, oh, you know what? Instagram is meant to be like for the cool kid, but TikTok is a bunch of losers who are just like dancing around and now. So there's, just to use that analysis, you don't know where the gold mine is. So cultural integration, investing abroad, going over, whatever. I think that's where the future is. That's where the gold in the future is. Yeah.
So it's really fascinating. And to hear you talk about it, quick aside, there is a direct flight from Miami to Lagos, which is the biggest city in Nigeria. So what is it, 25, 30 million people now?
Yeah, around that.
Yeah, no, that's insane. And then also the demographics,
if it's ever Nigerian trivia night, Scott's going to beat me.
I read a lot of about geography. And so this is like literally like tickling, like a very niche fancy of mine, and history and geopolitics as well. But in Nigeria, the History Channel that I follow on YouTube called What If Altist, he talks a lot. He references this one historian that uses that's accurately predicted a lot of kind of trends and things in history. And the name escapes me, but it's on the channel. Altist, the historian that he references, where demographics precipitate economics, and particularly when it comes to population. And that's why it is that we're seeing like India, that's why it is that we saw China explode, why it is that we saw India explode, why it is that we saw Nigeria explode, is that just based on because the demographics are really what drive demand in the economy and really what kind of precipitates the economic size of a given market. Yeah, I've had this pipe dream for a really long time of just like fucking setting shop in Africa and just living on the frontier and with my nothing but my hustler spirit.
it's that that could be a big, that could be a very big risk, but that could also be a big, that could be big success. There's a lot of stories. I've taken a couple of my friends to Nigeria, and everybody has had their experience. The hustle is intense, I'll tell you. The hustle is intense.
Almost, it sounds like there's people who moved to big cities, like people who moved to New York for that kind of buzz, that vibrancy of work ethos, and just like whether it's entrepreneurial spirit or the next big startup or whatever, there's a buzz that people get when they live in certain cities. And I feel like New York's kind of the king of that in the US in terms of what I'm talking about. And it sounds like what you're describing is just, it's like that on steroids of just, like you said, it's so palpable.
It's a concrete jungle for real. It's palpable in the sense that think about the New York with all the population, but not even 1%, no, let's say not even 10% of the infrastructure. Like, it's no rules. It's like everybody is doing what the heck they want to do. But inside that chaos, it seems like people understand the code. I don't know how the driving was when you went to Japan. Just segueing off a bit. But in China, the driving is really crazy, but people don't really have that much accidents. So that's just Nigeria. So
it's a controlled chaos.
Yeah,
It's a chaos that somehow, stabilizes or maintains some level of
human civilization.
But I actually think that level of unstructuredness, if that's a word, like that level of like just lack of general like rules and rigidity is actually advantageous to learning how to be an entrepreneur, because so I think it actually in some ways like that to me is an advantage when you, if you're a control for like income and intelligence and, you know, all the things, I think it's actually would be, I would actually consider it a better entrepreneurial education to grow up in that environment versus the schooling system in the US, which reinforces just a very rigid way of like understanding the rules and regurgitating them back. And then you have to, and then once you move to entrepreneurship, like the rules are meant to be broken. And oftentimes the people who break them in a elegant, sophisticated way end up garnering the lion's share of the results. So it's just interesting. That's just kind of me reflecting on just something that I've been working on is like, how do you really foster that spirit when you, So anyway, it's fascinating that, because some people could say, some people perceive that as a disadvantage. It's not it doesn't have the same whatever as the US, but in many ways, I think it can build more of resilience in like you said, a hustler's mentality or whatever you want to call it. There are things that come out of different environments and shape people in very meaningful ways.
Yeah, it's a skill. It's something, you put it the right way. That's what it is. So I think for entrepreneurship, I think that grit is needed. So that's what we all entrepreneurs from Nigeria or Africa, that's even Asia, is the same thing in Asia. That's also how I connected. That's what we all have found. The advantage of being in this environment is just, you know what? You just have to get shit done either ways, man. And
it's when you, before we're mandatory marketing questions, is when you focused on fashion and niche down to that, how did you market in Nigeria? Like, how did you get in front of potential clients?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, because B2B, okay? So B2B, big budget, it's not for every customer. So we are looking for the wholesalers, deals range in tens of thousands of dollars. So you need people who can pay that. And on that level, I don't know how it works in Canada. I'm still learning the Canadian market. On that level in Nigeria, it boils down to relationships. It boils down to trust, right? So people want to see whom they are dealing with. People want to know whom they are dealing with before somebody is going to invest or do a business of $50,000 with you. he wants to know you're not going to run away with his money. So getting in front of customers has to do a lot with doing your research properly to find out who are those people in the market who can buy these products. Practically, when I went into the market in Lagos, I had to go to the hubs where fashion is sold. And when I went to the hubs, then I had to find out whom were the big wholesalers, stores there. And after finding out who they were, I went with my clothing, simple cold calls, and made my presentations to these people. And I have, this is how, but the advantage also, and what you learn in that process is, because you already have the inventory, like in my situation, I have my inventory on ground in Lagos, sitting down there, and I'm asking you to come to my warehouse to see these products. So that's one in my favor, because if I'm able to bring inventory, what's XYZ, and now I'm just asking you to bring your cash and come take the inventory. In Nigeria, it's a big deal because I actually have this thing on ground. So you know that I'm serious. I'm not coming to get your money then run off, go buy it from somewhere and give it to you. So that's basically how to get in front of those customers in B2B. Find the customers, present to them, let them see what you have. And when they see what you have, they assess you, they know what's going on. They have a feel of you and they're like, okay, I'd like to deal. But that's still the first part of it. Closing those deals in Nigeria is very similar to closing deals in China. We close those deals over beer and peppered goat meat and snails. That's the truth. No, most of the guys who are going to do that kind of business with you are not very formal about it. So in this situation, some guys, giving you a typical example, some guys whom I closed a deal with, we closed it on a Sunday in his house. Sunday morning, all of us agreed to meet up in his house. This was after we had already had some conversations in his office during the week. He said, okay, no problem. Come to my house so that I can show you where I live. And I go there and he's had his chef cook some local dishes and everything. And there's all sorts of assorted wines and whiskeys and bourbon, whatever. And we're just eating. He invited a few other guys there. And he's like, okay, I just want to show you where I live. I want to introduce you to my friends so that you see how we are. And we're ready to do business with you. And by the time that we began to eat and the business deal was closed, and it was agreed right there on that table that, okay, they would come to the office tomorrow, sign the documents, transfer the money to my account, and business is done. So that's how the business is done in Nigeria. You don't have to wear your big suit and your tie and come. And on the flip side,
here nowadays.
Yeah, on the flip side, so I have a marketing team. And my marketer struggles a lot to close the deal. He was really struggling at some point. And I told him, I said, to be honest, the way you close these deals is you have to build the trust of the customer. That's how I learned it. I don't know how every other person learned it, but that's what has worked for me. You have to get to know these people. You have to be with them. They have to know that you're capable of handling transactions of this volume. It's easier when you work for, if it's over here in Canada, wherever you work for, maybe a big company, whatever, Microsoft, or whoever it is, that's the package you have. So everybody knows where to come find you. But if it's in Nigeria, you're therefore trying to do business, not everybody knows. So you have to find a way to warm yourself into the people and build some social proof. So yeah, does that work with what you already used to in terms of getting in front of customers?
There's so many different strategies or different methodologies. I can really appreciate the simplicity of that. You're like, yeah, I just found out who they were. I called them. We met with them. I met their friends and we closed. Yeah. We met their friends over pepper, goat, and
goat. Yeah.
But I think it's a really good needed reminder, because in the age of the internet and smartphones and LinkedIn and WeChat and like all these things, people get lost in the tactics of different ways of doing business, and they kind of lose the trees, they lose the forest for the trees, which is you have to gain the respect, gain their trust, know, like, and trust. And every, at this point, really every technological tactic is just getting in the way, or it's going to be less, it's like a less pure dose of the real you in with meeting them face to face or calling them on the phone. Like, the more you can remove and just get direct to somebody, that, so there is something to be said for just the old school, get it done, smile and dial, boiler room approach. Yeah. And
but that, again, here's our 36 step account based marketing funnel.
Yeah. So it's, this conversation actually, and I know companies have attempted this, be it like Better Business Bureau or LinkedIn, but between my story and your story that we've shared of, I don't even know if I'm talking to the right person. If I am talking to the right person, in your case, like, they know they're talking to Judeo for, can I trust him with $50,000? And it just really seems to be an opportunity that if there is a way to make it more apparent of, I am, because like you said, they didn't even believe who you were in your, with your code name or your alternate name in China and all that. So they didn't even believe that was you. And so there's just several layers to like identity and like just the legitimacy. And if I don't have the answer, but if there is a way to,
yeah,
just, if you had like a flashcard of, this verifies like I'm a real person. I've done this many transactions that have been proven. And I know Alibaba has review. Everything has like different, their form of reviews and whatever, but there's not a universally accepted thing of, this is my identity and this is the transactions I've done, or the whatever proof points you need to just try to expedite like the trust, let's call it even 70%, so that we could spend the last 30% having dinner with them, doing the stuff that you're doing of, okay, dude, do you even like me? But like, before we get to, if you like me, I would like to had for certain, I am who I say I am, and I've done these things before. So that does seem to be an opportunity. I think with more and more of the government's just stalking the fuck out of us and all that, I think things will go in that direction to where you're just more and more, there's no way around.
Oh yeah.
People will know if you fucked people over before.
Oh yeah. It definitely is something, like, I agree with your point. And the other thing to add is, of course, it doesn't mean that there is not digital marketing and social media and LinkedIn and everything happening. But again, it also has to do with the sector. So in B2B sales, even leave Nigeria, if you do B2B in China as well, a lot of it is also the same. Like, first thing in China is what they call guanxi. Guanxi means relationships. And that's actually, Chinese will tell you, that's actually how businesses get done. But it doesn't mean that there's not also the ways of targeting on social media, getting all those Instagram leads and LinkedIn leads and everything. However, when it comes to the B2B space, when you're like, for us at the time when we had this strategy was when we were building our 80-20. So what we figured as a business that we needed, first of all, are 20% of those customers whom could give us the revenue that would see us moving.
Right. Yeah.
Then,
because it goes both ways. Yeah. I mean, not only it's a, can I trust you with $50,000? Yeah. My question is, do you have $50,000? So this happened yesterday. I was on, because I do some brokering. I sell companies as a broker for people looking to sell. So hit me up on whatever the fuck social media. But this literally happened. If you want it that bad, you'll figure out a way to find it. But this literally happened yesterday, where I got on a call from a guy that he reached out to me on LinkedIn. So that's point number one. And he's, oh, I'm looking to acquire these different e-commerce companies. And I said, okay, well, I may have some that fit your bill. I have a 16 million, a 20 million, whatever. I have a few in inventory that I could talk to you about. And we get on, this literally yesterday, we get on the phone. And again, he came to me on LinkedIn. We get on the phone and he's like, okay, so what do you got? And I'm like, what do I got? Okay. Oh, so you thought I was going to sell myself on this phone call. Well, that's funny, because I was hoping you would sell yours. Cause like, I, these are very,
that to him?
What did you say? No, I didn't know. That's just me like just rambling to try to like confuse people, because I was so awkward. But no, it was amazing, because I'm like, we're talking about some serious size companies, and I need to know, as the broker, I'm in the middle. So I need to know, like, you're the legitimate buyer. So as much as you want me to sell myself and sell the fact that
we have these great companies, or we can handle your $50,000 in your case. There's a whole other set of the thing of, are you even worth talking to? Do you even have the kind of money? Do you have the money or expertise?
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's just amazing because everyone's just trying to gauge everyone. And you're just going off of like instincts. And I'm like, all right, well, this guy, I don't think he's that, I don't know, he's serious, but it's just amazing. Business is still done by just sizing people true. Up.
Yeah, that's what it is at the end of the day. So in China, for example, let me give you, I always like to go back to my Chinese experience, right? So when you go to the business, from my experience, first day, these guys host you to a banquet. They don't even talk about business. He takes you out, you eat a lot, you drink a lot. He keeps telling you every, you know what? Let's just be friends. Let's make a relationship. And that's guanxi. That's what it is. So guanxi is when they meet you, first of all, they want to build on the, understand each other. And that also has influenced my philosophy where I say, what? The basis of doing business is culture. When you are going to do a business, first of all, understand each other's culture. We here in the West call it values. That's the value system, because everything is rosy when you want to do a business. But tomorrow when it crashes, then that's when we now start looking for how to talk to Brian in a nice way and get him to change his mind on taking us to court and all. But if we have something established before then, guanxi, culture, values, then that's what we bounce back to. So anyway, you go to your dinners with them and everything. And it's only until like later on that you now go into talking about this. And there's a trick there. I'm sure you must have also heard about this. So it's either then you've drank a bit and you're loose-lipped and you just go with whatever proposition you're giving, or you all have also relaxed a bit and you're able to talk about business. So that's what I've learned in B2B. When you're taking containers of products from factories and sending it over to somewhere, yeah, you could start in an office, but at the end of the day, sometimes it really boils down to you and this guy sitting down and being like, yeah, so what, are we what doing this together or not, that kind of thing. So yeah
man, no, we're coming up on 90 minutes. That one flew by. But yeah. Judeo 4, what are, just quick as a way to kind of sign off here, like what, because I know you have the wholesaling fashion, you're also expanding to do that in Canada as well. You also have the lithium mining in Nigeria, which we didn't even talk about. And where can folks find you?
I'm on LinkedIn in my name, Judofo Ahaneku. Email address, first name, last name @gobuyhub.com. Yeah, I'm pretty much hanging out anywhere. Just like Brian, if you want me bad enough, I'm sure you'll be able to find me.
I stayed away from your last name on the intro because I was like self-conscious about for now.
You are not sure about that one. You know, it's not.
And I was also self-conscious about asking you and then you telling me and then still fucking it up.
I've gone by so many different names. Listen, it's not only here in Nigeria. My name is Judofo. In Nigeria, Judofo is an Igbo name. We have a lot of tribes, Brian. I'm sure Scott already has done a bit of, he knows a little bit of this since he reads geography and politics. So we have a lot of different tribes in Nigeria, but we have three main tribes, like we like to say, Igbo, Hausa, Yoruba. So I'm Igbo and my name is Jidofo. In Yoruba, Jide, J-I-D-E, which is the first part of my name, is a name of its own. So when I went to school in Nigeria, secondary school, in my school, people would just call me Jide. So automatically they converted me to a Yoruba person. Then when I left Nigeria, people began to call me Jay. Then I became English. So what I'm trying to say is that my name, I'm used to it already. It just takes different variations depending on who's calling.
Interesting. Well, take care, everybody. Signing off.
All right, guys. Yeah. It's been nice to connect, man. Thanks for inviting me on the podcast and looking forward to the ayahuasca at some point, right, Scott?
Yeah, absolutely. You're going to have to come on down.
Yeah, we'll see.
We'll record part two.
All right. Looking forward to that, guys. Thank you.
Now, with this episode at a close, let's fucking vamos on out of here.